I'm not like them, but I can pretend. I think I'm dumb, maybe just happy. I think I'm dumb.
All right, well, we're on, so anything we say now is on the record. Welcome back to Thoughts and Prayers.
Thank you, Q, for that perfunctory introduction there.
It's like my unenthusiastic.
Welcome back, Q&A, back at it once again. Today we're joined by some TNP All-Stars, some of our favorite guests who've been on the show multiple times. We've got Mr. My Fitness Feelings. Welcome, Fitz.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And in the other corner, we've got the esteemed Pool House, aka DJ Pool House, or aka Pool House the Elder. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. This is a dream come true to be here with Fitz and the boys. This is great.
So, how's everybody doing? Q, what's going on?
I'm good. I feel a little out of it because I went to Nicki Minaj last night with Basil. Honestly, I've never been to a big concert like that. And I did feel very MK Ultra'd. Like, it's just like you're in this giant arena and there's all this like pyrotechnics and like it just felt really, I don't know how to explain it. It made me feel really insane to be inside of it. But I had fun.
Are there any portions of the event that you don't recall?
I kind of like don't remember like any of it, sort of. Because like when I looked back on it, it's just this giant like blur of, I don't know. I don't know how anyone could really focus on any one thing at an event like that, you know?
Do you know if it was the real Nicki or the clone Nicki? Because my understanding is she sends like a clone out sometimes.
I couldn't really, we didn't have the best seat, so I couldn't really like see her that well. So she was really, really, really tiny. So honestly, it could have been anyone on that stage. So
was there any good like shit talking or, you know, like crowd work or any stuff like that?
No, not really. No. Just sort of the standard. I guess what I imagine would be a standard.
No, like unhinged Kanye rants or anything.
No crazy special guest. She wasn't like, and here's Beyonce or something like that. So Nicki's kind of canceled because she's sort of like a little, I don't know. She didn't get the box, remember? Allegedly.
Yeah.
Well, there's that situation with her her relative's friend, I believe, with his balls. She did a public service. I feel like she did a public service.
What happened? His balls fell off or something?
They got swollen after he got the bag. So that's why she didn't get the bag. But honestly, I felt a little, I was like, this is our biggest anti-vax celebrity, which is, you know, I support it. I mean, good for you, Nicki.
There have been a few. Rob Schneider.
Brand.
it's a crew, you know.
Yeah. How are you doing, A? You had the family week all week, right?
Yes. Daycare closed for the week for spring break, they're calling it, but
babies getting spring break is so funny. Like little babies.
It's been chill. My wife took him out for the evening, so I'm actually kind of just been chilling, and I'm kind of ready to get into some AIDS denial here.
With HIV denial.
That's right. That's true. More accurate.
They always suck at like the slanders. The names always like that they give us, like AIDS denier, like, I don't know, transphobe. They just suck. I don't know. I feel like they could, I don't know, do better than AIDS denier. What are we denying? No one's denying anything. I don't know.
Yeah, well, especially, and as we'll get into it, but Pool House, you're really not denying anything. So
it's all true. I deny nothing.
But so, yeah, I guess, I mean, I feel like we can just jump into it because I feel like there's a lot here and I want to make sure that everyone can say everything. I'm sure there's going to be questions and all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, we're here to talk AIDS. And we've got Fitz on the one hand representing one kind of perspective, I guess, on the issue, and Poolhouse here will be kind of bringing a different perspective to the table. I think it's going to be a good conversation. I think that maybe these two perspectives have more in common than may even it may appear at first, but
so I'm here to ask questions for our gay and female listeners who don't.
Yeah, Well, I thought so. I mean,
don't have the brain capacity to understand the science.
Yeah, I think there's a. I wanted to actually kind of have you kick it off, Q, at first, because so, like, I mean, basically, if you're a regular listener to our podcast, you kind of get the idea that, like, basically, we talk about how all these mainstream narratives are like fake and gay. And that basically any kind of prominent historical event or media narrative is varying degrees of like somewhat fake to complete bullshit. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that AIDS also kind of fits into that category. So I thought maybe we could just, before we even get into these kind of like two, I guess, sort of alternative viewpoints, just kind of discuss HIV, AIDS more broadly as like a PSYOP and kind of set up the conversation that way. So Q, I thought maybe you could give us sort of the official narrative on HIV, AIDS, since you're not well versed in the alternative theories and just kind of like what like most people probably think the story is on AIDS.
Sure. I'll give the faggot narrative because that really is what it is, our people's Holocaust. Yeah, I guess the official narrative as far as, you know, all the gay writers and stuff, I have some of their books on my shelf right here, say Larry Kramer, is that there was this HIV was a virus that at some point pre the 1960s, and I think they've managed, again, we'll see what you guys say, but they say they've managed to trace finding the virus as far back as like the early 1900s, but at some point it transferred from, this is the official narrative again, I'm not saying I believe this, I'm just giving the official narrative. It transferred from monkeys to humans somewhere in Africa via the bushmeat trade, which is where they kill monkeys, I think, and eat them. And then around the late 1970s, it sort of entered into the, at least from the US perspective, the gay male population, primarily white, like middle class gay men. And then it sort of ravaged that community in particular, killed a ton of people in that community. So that's sort of like the, I guess, romantic queer history version. It killed a lot of like artists and writers and people like that. Keith Haring, I think, died of AIDS, famously, just one example. but obviously, there was a ton of people who did not die and who have lived with the virus for many, many decades, including some celebrities and people like that. So, you know, there's always been sort of questions about who died and why. And the and I guess the biggest recent change is that in the last maybe 10 to 15 years, this is the mainstream narrative. The medications have gotten so good that you can live with HIV in perpetuity without getting sick. And you can even take medicine as a preventative measure to get HIV. So now, at least in first world countries, nobody is dying of AIDS anymore is sort of the narrative. And then there's this whole other sort of element that I feel like is ignored in the US perspective, but they're like, all of Africa's dying of AIDS, but like that's all you really know about it as a normie American, and there's no like real engagement with that. But they seem to throw that in. They're like European and American faggots and then half the continent of Africa, but no one really talks about the African part. I would say that's sort of the mainstream narrative, right? Basically what I just said.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember it like, just to kind of emphasize like the PSYOP aspect of it. Like, I don't know about what y'all's experience was, but I had like a full on like AIDS unit at some point in school where we like learn about all this stuff and like learn about this kid, like this sad story about this kid who like got AIDS from a blood transfusion and like all this stuff. And it was almost comparable to me of like how we had DARE with like the drugs and they teach you like about all the different drugs or whatever. And yeah, it was kind of like that, like this weird, like, I don't know, like it seemed like AIDS was basically kind of over or whatever, like by the time I was in school. But then at the same time, we still had to like learn all about it and like how scary it was. And I don't know. So that I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, part of the mainstream narrative, which I think I'm sure both of them will get into, is that anyone can get HIV, no matter what type of sex you're having. And it's like, yeah, that's sort of part of it, which is, even if you really look at statistics in the mainstream narrative, that's kind of ridiculous. There's only a few specific types of people who get HIV, but that was, I feel like those school,
well, apparently in Africa, like straight people do get it.
So right. Right. But that whole thing and the whole school thing with like the DARE aligned curriculum is definitely like telling kids like you could get HIV if you don't wear a condom, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, but definitely like a fear mongering element, which I know in like our episode, one of our episodes with David M, we kind of talked about on different dimensions, like analogies between COVID and AIDS. And one of them being that one of the key players in both was Fauci.
Yeah, Fauci was big. I think it's also worth mentioning that a lot of the U.S. left like likes to say, before we get into Fauci, just a lot of the U.S. left likes to blame Reagan and Republicans for AIDS. So that's
for ignoring it because it was a gay disease.
Right. But like ostensibly, if this mainstream narrative is true, there wasn't a whole lot Reagan could have really done about it. But yeah, that's part of it too. But yeah, Fauci famously big in the AIDS, I guess, in the 80s. That was his like sort of rise to power.
He was doing his research in the bathhouses. He was on the scene.
Yeah.
So he really says that. So
no, I know.
So okay. So before we again get into the I guess different perspectives here, does either of you have any thoughts just on, I guess, like maybe what was the, if you want to call it objectives or just if not objectives, then consequences or something like that of the AIDS PSYOP, like any sort of analysis on that dimension of it?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to say without like getting into it, but I think that I would just put out there for people that something about AIDS, I mean, it I think at the most basic level is that it reinforced the idea that viruses and virology is this really important thing. And we need to give these people a lot of power over our lives to sort of dictate how we live and who we sleep with. And I mean, you know, it went a long way towards establishing biomedical control basically over society as such, like in the deepest and kind of most intimate areas. So I think I would just kind of throw that out for people to think about before we kind of get into it.
No, I agree. I think I came to this through like research about COVID-19, right? Like the lab origin, the way that that was administered and kind of propagandized, and the vaccine program there, and its connections to like the deep state, to like the military programs, and the science. I guess what I call the science, or what we call the science, which to me is the like kind of the culprit always. What Fitz is saying is true, I think, and I think what I kind of believe is also true, which is that the science is the deep state in some ways. I think the science is the military industrial complex. They rely on the science for all of their like capabilities, for all of their technology, and all of their programs they implement. Like it's all very much interconnected, and all the funding for the science comes from, or a lot of it comes from, you know, government funding, from, you know, DOD, from NIH and things like that. And so I think, I mean, I see AIDS and HIV AIDS, I guess you could call it, and COVID-19 as part of like a broader kind of attack on people, like a degradation of human health. And I think that could include things that are like, cancers and autism rates and allergies and things like Ebola or RSV, like actual viruses. But I see it as a much broader program, and it's about the way that like public health and vaccines and virology and all these different kind of covers in the science are kind of used to carry those like kind of operations out, I guess.
I think from an emotional perspective too, if you want to like just dip your toe in it, like think about the way it makes people feel. Like, I think AIDS is really scary, you know, and it's like, and I feel like that's how a lot of people felt during COVID. And I think that that's a feeling that's really powerful and that the government uses well. Like, if you can get people freaked out enough, you can kind of get them to do anything, you know.
I call it plague mindset, and it's what you were describing being taught like in school. And I'm a little bit older than you guys, but like definitely AIDS was not like a threat to me as like an 8-year-old or whatever, right? But I remember like just being kind of indoctrinated with a lot of stuff and not even really realizing till COVID just how like I had carried that with me like my whole life. I had this kind of like in the back of my brain, like this like plague mindset, you know, which what does that lead to? It gets you to trust, you know, science and authority.
Yeah, I think if you're gay, it's really nailed home. Like, I can't go to, like, my regular doctor now, like, still, unless I say I don't want it, will, like, do an HIV test, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's, like, I feel like if you're, that's part of, like, gay people being, like, super medicalized, right? It's, like, that's why we talk about trans people being, like, perma-pharma patients, but they're definitely, gay people were really the vanguard in the perma pharma patients front. So,
yeah. And I think I just wanted to add something that Poolhouse said, which I definitely agree with, is that the scientific industrial complex being essentially one and the same with the military industrial complex. And just a shout out to a lot of conspiracy heads will like reference this farewell speech of President Eisenhower. And that was where he kind of coined the term military industrial complex as a warning against basically that industry basically taking control over the government, which is exactly what happened. But less discussed is immediately after that part of the speech, he then says the same thing about the scientific technological elite. And yeah, I think, so it's like he kind of understood that connection, even back then. So, all right, well, I guess we can just jump into it. I think the best way here is to just give each of you a little time to kind of give the broad strokes of your perspective on the kind of, alternative narrative on HIV AIDS. So, maybe let's start with Fitz here.
Sure. And yeah, similar to what Poolhouse said, if I just start going on for way too long, I mean, just obviously cut me off. no hard feelings. It's an issue that I'm very passionate about. So I guess what I will say is that I think that the basic, it sort of as an introduction, I think the basic mistake that was made by Bob Gallo and Anthony Fauci, and I think even some of the AIDS conspiracists, is a very old mistake and a very common one in medical practice, which is basically to assume that because the number of cases of a syndrome in a community are rising, that the syndrome must be contagious and caused by a single microbe. And so to understand what happened with AIDS in the 80s and 90s and to some extent the 2000s, I want to briefly take people way back, right, to the 1500s, when you had the age of exploration, and there's huge issues with the disease at this time, particularly scurvy. And there's a lot of interesting research on this front. There's a guy in particular, Sir Richard Hawkins, who was a British admiral. He discovered, I think it was in 1593, when they were sailing to Brazil, that this disease was breaking out on his ship, and that they could cure it by eating lemons and oranges that they got on the other side. And concurrent to this, a lot of other explorers of all kind of different nationalities were having the same realizations. But despite these discoveries, no one ever sort of put together that scurvy was not a contagious disease, really until hundreds of years later, when this British naval surgeon published a book arguing that it was, you know, entirely caused by diet. And he was, despite the fact that he really proved it in this book, the medical community did not accept his thesis. It was actually not until the 1930s when they isolated vitamin C and proved definitively that that was the cause of scurvy that the doctors finally sort of step back and it say, okay, this is a lifestyle condition that's caused by diet. You see this same pattern over and over again in medicine. There was an epidemic called SMON in Japan in the 60s and 70s that was very similar. You had the same thing with beriberi and pellagra. Pellagra was a disease that, you know, it would hit people in rural communities very hard, particularly in the United States in the post-Civil War South. And it seemed highly contagious. It would spread through these things like wildfire. And, you know, children would be actually taken from their families and placed in orphanages where they would then not get the disease, which seemed to confirm that it was infectious. And it wasn't until the 20th century again, this guy, Dr. Joseph Goldberger, he proved that it was a lack of niacin, that it was a vitamin B deficiency that was found in wheat. And that was a part of the standard diet in orphanages, but the poor Southerners at the time lived mostly on corn, which doesn't have any niacin. And so, again, eventually, once they isolated the B vitamins, they were kind of forced to relent and admit that, okay, actually, this is not caused by a microbe. It's basically my contention that Duisberg was the first person to understand that something very much like scurvy or pellagra was happening in the urban homosexual community in the 80s and 90s. And I think his objections, much like his predecessor, Dr. Lind, who I mentioned earlier, his objections were very reasonable, I think, were overruled by virologists who desperately needed another viral epidemic similar to polio to shore up their status in the biomedical scientists, and the public was eager for a way to displace blame onto a kind of external cause. I don't think that Duisberg is totally right about what causes AIDS. We can talk about that. I think that's a really complicated and in some ways abstract question. But I think he is right about what does not cause it, and that is HIV. That may seem like a crazy thing if you're listening to this, right? But I just want to put out there for context. So the average person hosts about 30 to 40 trillion different bacteria and about 300 to 400 trillion viruses at any given time. So we're filled with microbes. And as a result of that, we have something called Koch's postulates. These are created by Robert Koch, who's a German physician and microbiologist. He discovered anthrax and a whole bunch of other infectious diseases. And he developed these standards because when someone, a patient, is suffering from a medical syndrome, you can extract some microbe, a parasite, a virus, a bacteria from them and say, okay, well, this is what's causing the disease, right? But we have so many in our body that you have to really be sure, is this microbe really what's causing the condition? And so what Koch did was he said, okay, in order to say that a microbe causes this disease, it has to meet three categories. So in sort of summarizing Duisberg's position, I'm going to start with this, right? Because I think HIV does not meet these. And it's because I think will be a good introduction to the issue, right? So the first thing is we have to be able to say the microbe in question, the virus in question, is found in all cases of the disease. So if there are people who are getting a disease in the absence of this microbe, right, that's a strong sign that the microbe is not the cause, right? We have to find this in the patient. So like, let's take HIV, for example. In most AIDS patients, they really do not find any significant amounts of HIV at all, right? When it is found in very small quantities. Usually only one in every about 500 T cells contains dormant virus. And this issue of the idea of a dormant virus is very important because, you know, people think an HIV test, like I'm testing positive. They think you're testing positive for the virus, but that is actually not what the test does. The test is for antibodies, right? So the test is showing that you've already contracted HIV, that you've developed an immunity to it, and those antibodies have suppressed it in your system and it's sort of lying dormant. So when we start to think about this, how can, I mean, that seems to prove that the immune system is in fact active and can counter the virus. So why it would then years later turn on and sort of annihilate the host is something that medical science has not really addressed. But we'll get to that. So then the other thing is that when you look at, for example, a lot of the early AIDS deaths, which were basically urban, you know, gay men in urban scenarios, about a quarter of those patients were never tested for HIV at all. So they were just assumed to have the virus, and we really have no idea. And then on top of that, we have these two other patient categories. One is there are about 5,000 CDC confirmed cases of AIDS where the person was not HIV positive. And on the other hand, there are millions of cases of where someone is HIV positive and they never get AIDS. So right off the bat, this tells us this should be very troubling for the thesis that HIV alone causes it. Because logically, if it causes it, right, it should cause it in every case, right? We shouldn't have people getting AIDS where they don't have HIV, right? So this is not good for the thesis, right? The second thing is you have to be able to isolate and grow this virus, right, in a pure culture. They are able to do that, right, I will admit. However, they had a lot of problems with it because the virus is so dormant in these patients that in order to reactivate it and get it to grow, they have to apply powerful electromagnetic currents. Otherwise, it just sits and doesn't replicate, right? And so then the third thing is that they have to basically, you have to be able to reproduce the original disease by giving the microbe to an animal or to another person. Obviously, it'd be very unethical to infect people with HIV. But they did attempt to give AIDS to all kinds of animals by injecting them to HIV. And none of them ever got the disease. None of the monkeys, nothing. They were all completely fine. They lived completely healthy lives. It was a complete failure, right? And other studies of population groups that were exposed heavily to HIV, for example, hemophiliacs during this time, like you would think that hemophiliacs would be wiped out, right, during AIDS because they're relied on the blood supply. In fact, their median lifespan doubled during that time, right? And then further, the army, right, started testing people for HIV, and they found all kinds of young men in places like Montana, like really remote rural areas. You know, it's really unlikely that all of those men were so sexually active that they got HIV. And so it's pretty likely that they got it from their mothers, which suggests that it is neither universally deadly, nor did it actually originate in any of these kind of population centers. And finally, on this point, I'll just note that we grow HIV, the virus, in T cells, in culture. And never once has someone been able to observe the actual mechanism where it turns on and destroys those T cells. It does not happen, right? You can just grow it in there infinitely. It never turns on the T cells and attacks them. So in short, in AIDS patients, right, you have this virus that's been in the host for years prior to the disease. It's inactive and rare during the disease, and it's not present in every case of the disease. So that right off the bat is like, there's something wrong with this hypothesis, right? But it gets even worse. So then the AIDS really does not conform to the model of infectious disease at all. So one, infectious diseases do not discriminate, for example, closely between men and women, right? They don't generally kill their host. They generally are easy to transmit, right? Like early studies of gay couples where one person was HIV positive, they found that it took 1,000 unprotected sexual contacts, right? Like unprotected anal intercourse to pass the virus once, right? That is not a good reproduction strategy for a virus. Second, okay, HIV does not follow Farr's law. We're all familiar with this from COVID, which is the idea that viruses explode and contract in an exponential kind of rise and fall pattern during pandemics. The reality is that when you adjust the number of AIDS, basically HIV positives, for the number of tests, it's consistent, right? Like in the United States, it never grows. It's just about 1 million people have it, and that's it. It doesn't expand, doesn't contract, right? Nothing about that conforms to the idea of a virus that kind of exploded into the population out of some sort of new area, right? So the basic premise is a disease that's universally fatal and almost impossible to transmit, in which the marker of the disease is antibodies to the disease, which is inactivated in almost every case. So again, this is not making sense. So I'll just address finally two other things that people may bring up. So the first is the issue of viral latency, which is, we all know this about AIDS, is that you get it, you may not know, you may not be sick at all, but it can cause real problems for you, you know, 2 years down the road, 10 years down the road. So this idea of a slow virus was invented by this guy, Carlton Gadjdik, who was really a complete hack. And he basically, you know, you can read about it in Duisberg's book, but it comes from this disease called Kuru, which is he alleged it was a disease that people got in New Guinea from cannibalizing the brains of their ancestors. And he completely failed to show there's any virus involved, right? Like he tried every which way to sort of transmit a disease from the brains or whatever. It didn't work. And then it basically came out that he had faked the pictures of the cannibal acts and that really no one had even seen the cannibalism. He was investigated by a number of anthropologists who basically determined that there wasn't any cannibalism on this island, right? So he won the Nobel Prize for that. But the reality is that this premise of viruses that, you know, invade your body, they have a kind of effect, they're dormant, and then years down the road, they just explode and kill you and cause all this stuff. That's just not how viruses work, right? And that's one of the things that, for example, Duisberg worked on. And so usually when I get to this point in talking to people, I'll stop after this, the last thing is people will say, well, what about Africa, right? And Q, you brought that up a second ago. Like, well, doesn't that prove that it's a huge problem? So I'll just throw a few things out here. So the first is that African and Western AIDS diseases, a lot of people don't know this, are different. Okay, so the AIDS diseases that you get in Africa are just the kinds of diseases that Africans tend to get, right? In other words, Kaposi sarcoma was, now they've had to abandon that now because no one gets it anymore, but that was one of the original sort of AIDS diseases. Obviously, you never see that in Africa. In Africa, it's basically you get tuberculosis, fever, diarrhea, right, and some weight loss. And of course, these are people living in extremely malnourished conditions, often drinking out of polluted water. They don't have access to a lot of food or medicine or whatever. The fact that they might have tuberculosis or a fever or weight loss or diarrhea is not particularly shocking, nor does it indicate this virus, right? And there's no explanation, for example, for why the virus causes a completely different set of effects in one place than it does in another place, right? And there have been studies of HIV in Africa. One was even published in Nature, where they tracked, for example, African prostitutes who tested HIV positive. They came back at 5 and 10 year intervals. None of them ever died of the virus, right? They were completely fine, contrary to all the predictions. And so the last two points on this Africa thing I'll say are this. So the first is that the rates of basically HIV converting to AIDS in Africa are radically different both across Africa and across the entire world. So to give you an example, Uganda is considered to be like a testing kind of gold standard for Africa. And there's a 1 million positive out of a million HIV positives that only generated 8,000 cases of AIDS. Okay. In Zaire, there was 3 million HIV positives that only generated a few hundred cases of what they're alleging to be AIDS. Compare this to the US, right? In the same time frame, there were 1 million HIV positives, which generated basically 400,000 to 500,000 AIDS cases. This is an insanely different proportion, right? Which there is, again, no explanation for. And furthermore, like a lot of these countries, South Africa, for example, it's grown, the population has grown from, like, let's say over the past 12 to 15 years, from about 50 to 62 million people, all right, when about 14% of the population is HIV positive and should be dying from AIDS. Like, how is that population growth possible if more than a tenth, if more than one in every 10 people has a fatal immune-destroying disease, right? It just doesn't make sense. And I mean, I think broadly speaking, the entire narrative of AIDS is that it really functions more, and part of the reason why there's no, as Mullis remarks, like there's no Nobel Prize for the person who discovered this relationship. There's no paper that proves that HIV causes AIDS. This is all missing. And so what it really functions as is kind of a superordinate category, which lumps together a host of different conditions with different causes under a single umbrella, right, that we call AIDS. And it's used to kind of launder money and terrify people and a kind of a broad variety of other things. But I would say that, in my view, there's definitely a lot of malfeasance and I think government sort of wrongdoing. But I think people jump too quickly into it without sort of addressing the kind of basic scientific facts, which are that there really just isn't any evidence that HIV itself is causing these problems, and that I think we should be more critical of that story.
All right. All right. Very well stated. So yeah, that's Fitz's kind of perspective here, which is, I guess, more or less the kind of Peter Duisberg perspective. I know you mentioned that you do disagree with him on some things, such as what he does suggest is the actual cause of the AIDS diseases, which we can get into later. And maybe some other things we can talk about. But first, I thought we just jump over to Pool House to let him kind of introduce his point of view on the subject. And I realized I should have shouted this out earlier in the show, but I'll do it now, that Pool House has actually been doing a series of both showcasing his research and the research of his associate, Nick Petoskey, is that right?
Sure. Yeah, Nick. Yeah, Nick.
Nick, and also doing interviews with people who lived through the AIDS crisis and share their stories and kind of their perspectives that often differ from the mainstream one as well. So if anyone's interested after listening to this show, definitely worthwhile to check out Here Comes the Backlash, the Unsilencing series. So with that, I'll hand it off to Pool House.
Cool. Thanks, A, for plugging that. I think it's not as gay as it sounds, I promise. It's super, it's really interesting looking into history. And yeah, alternative, I guess, yeah, visions like we're kind of doing here tonight, or versions of like the history. And I want to say, like, I think a lot of what Fitz just said is like definitely true. I there's probably things I disagree with, but I will say broadly, I think there is a scientific fraud being perpetrated around AIDS. I think there's a lot of misrepresentation of the facts, I guess, and it's totally, everything he says is really accurate, I think, and broadly it was all very, is true, right? And I don't think it actually contradicts necessarily what I kind of view, because I think AIDS, it is a collection of symptoms, right? And I think a lot of things could be happening that are kind of being laundered under AIDS. And I think I do think there is a component to this that is like a bio attack, as Dr. Strucker, this kind of a whistleblower in the 80s, called it a bio attack. And I think it is related to the science, I guess. I would just say that some people in this theory, like there's like Dr. Leon Horowitz, he wrote a book called Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola. You can maybe see that as like a counter point or a different version of the AIDS hypothesis, I guess, counter to Duisberg. He kind of blames like Nazis. Some other people blame Soviet Russia. I don't actually like view it ideologically at all. I think there's kind of a scientific brotherhood. And if there is some kind of deep state cabal, I think it does kind of transcend any kind of like ideology. I think it's something deeper, and I think it is something that's very possible. And I think the research that I kind of like have come to find, it begs questions. So whether it's correct or not, you know, if I'm wrong about the HIV or the AIDS piece of it, this program does exist. There is a program that undertakes biological research into programs that want to disrupt immune systems, that want to degrade human health, that want to like limit and control population and reproduction. And I think that's all kind of part of this story for sure. I blame vaccines always for everything in life and society. So we start with the kind of vaccines. I won't go into the polio vaccine a whole lot, but I think that's a good place to start because the process of making vaccines is very, it's gruesome. They take a lot of, they take monkeys and they get them sick and they take their like kidneys or whatever and they extract pus and then they like grow cell lines out of the pus and then they'll like grow things out of that or whatever and inject that into like some other animal's bloodstream, and you know they like, go through a lot and they'll test it in a person eventually and they'll make a biological product. The polio vaccine has its own storied history, but I will shout out the Highwire yesterday. It's a March 28th episode, has a great segment on Dr. Bernice Eddy. She It's like a whistleblower in the 50s. She's a scientist, and she discovered in her research that one of the polio vaccine like batches had SV40 in it, which is like a cancer causing virus from monkeys. Around this time, I think three other vaccines, like RSV, kind of came from like a vaccine. Apparently, it was like from chimpanzee kind of cell lines that were used in the production there. And the implication being that this kind of messy process of making the vaccines is resulting in disease and in illness. This guy, Dr. Maurice Hilleman from Merck, he is like important in the HIV kind of alternative theory that I guess I'm proponing or a proponent of. He said nothing's it's not a big deal. SV40 is fine. He became like the world authority on SV40, which is a thing in the science. There's always these like viruses, and then some person just becomes the authority, and you can't challenge them. And so that was Hilleman in this case. He would later go on to study actually homosexuals and hemophiliacs in the 70s. He was really interested in their blood for whatever reason over at Merck. He privately, though, in the scientific literature, though, they do like in the 60s start to research like oncogenic virology, like the idea that some viruses cause cancers. They start this whole field of medical primatology. So they're studying like monkey viruses and human viruses and the interactions, I guess, kind of between those. There's a program called the Special Virus Cancer Program that starts in 1964. And they're kind of trying to see not just like cancer viruses, but they do in their literature, they kind of, first of all, it's classified. It's being run out of like Fort Detrick and National Cancer Institute. They're doing kind of research into viruses that can maybe cause disease, like that could hurt people, that could cause, latency is actually, it's interesting. So if it's broad latency, that's kind of some of the stuff they look into are things that could potentially be dormant intentionally, almost like bioweapons, essentially, which is also kind of what's happening in the deep state, in the military industrial complex, like at that time in the 60s. You have the rise of kind of like a lot of kind of paranoia, I guess, you know, there's a whole Cold War or whatever. And so there's a lot of kind of need to kind of, I guess, research biological weapons because the enemy could be doing these viruses or whatever. I think a lot of this is actually like just kind of stimulation for that kind of research. I'm not even sure their threat was really that real, but I think that there's this whole idea that we need these programs. So they do a lot of research into it. They sign a treaty in 1969 to kind of not do biological weapons research, but there's these like loopholes in it. And in 72, actually, like Nixon kind of does this like war on cancer, he calls it. It's kind of like his program to kind of stamp out cancer or whatever. It reminds me very much of Biden's cancer moonshot, in fact, because the whole thing is actually biodefense research. It's like a cover. So they're using these special cancer virus people like Dr. Gallo, who is doing all this research into like monkey viruses that like basically will destroy people's immune systems or whatever. They're doing all this research with the idea it's going to help or cure cancer, but it's really kind of to fuel this, whatever this biological program is. It does also coincide with the rise of like genomics. So you have a lot of like the interest in mapping out the human genome at this time. DNA or like genetic recombination. So they're starting to be able to kind of splice different types of viruses or whatever. I don't know. This all kind of culminates, I guess, with like, oh, also just like depopulation. People get mad when I talk about depopulation, but there is the 1974 like UN population or yeah, World Population Conference. They have the World Population Action Plan that they put out there. That's the same time as like Memorandum 200, which is a document from Kissinger, kind of his like population control strategy, I guess. I think Limits of Growth from the Club of Rome is around this time. It's in the air. This is the same people who are doing biodefense, right? These are the military industrial complex and you know, the public-private partnership. These are elite actors, and they're really interested in kind of managing the population. So you do have to wonder if they're could be overlap. And there are lots of instances where there are biological research programs tested on populations and not just Tuskegee. Tuskegee always gets held up. I think that's like, whatever Tuskegee. There's a lot of other ones that happen. It's way more than you would ever expect. One thing that happens is a school called Willowbrook, which is like an orphanage where these kids get like hepatitis from these scientists from the NIH. And they're like, it's very much like what happens in Dr. Fauci's own biography. He has this whole other, you know, episode where he kind of does experimentation on like, or he's overseeing, I guess, you know, a trial that does experimentation on like a state facility with orphans. They do this all the time. This is like a program. It's like a playbook. And so this one scientist gets pulled off of the Willowbrook thing when Geraldo breaks the scandal. And it's like, these kids are being given hepatitis or whatever. They move that scientist over to another hepatitis program called HepTivax, which is a Merck-run study. They're trying to get a hepatitis vaccine, which is, I guess, an STD. In the 70s, you know, like homosexuals get... it no longer becomes like illegal to be a faggot, I guess, anymore. So like homosexuals get deprecated from the DSM. So they're no longer considered a mental disorder. There's a lot more acceptance of it. There is a increase in outward expression or a community or a gathering of like homosexuals through like disco music and things like that. So there is kind of an emerging market, you could say, for new vaccines. And Merck takes advantage of this. They do this study called HepTivax, which they do it not just on gay people, but they do a special serum in the trial just for the homosexual men. And they do a whole propaganda campaign in New York City to like get gay men to take part in this study. The posters say like, this is your last chance, like this, get this vaccine. They want the most sluttiest men they can find. They really want very promiscuous men for this study. They recruit a bunch of them into this study. They tried to bury it, but there's a study that you can find in the literature from 72 to 73 on gay men in New York also that they've talked about in 75, where they lost track of most of the participants for whatever reason, which it sounds like may have coincided with this kind of rise in death and disease amongst gay men in New York, which starts a lot earlier than I think people realize. There's accounts of it in 75, 76 already. So that could be coinciding with these earlier trials going on in the city targeting gay men. But after the 78 trial, the HepTivax study, a lot of people start going missing. Like people say that like men start going away. People start getting sick, partners of men, some of these spreads through the city, and there's a whisper of kind of like death. And it's a lot earlier than the timeline kind of officially kind of dictates, I guess. It's not really even recognized until 1981, I think, in the New York Times. Is officially when, you know, HIV, or not even HIV, but a gay men's crisis is kind of being identified in New York City. My people I've talked to on the show on the unsilencing, they say it did start earlier. I think it's interesting. New York is hit very, very hard with HIV AIDS, which also kind of reminds me of COVID-19 as well, where, mm-hmm. I don't know, when you look at the kind of the trial sites for this HepTivax study and where HIV breaks out, there is a lot of overlap there. So I think, to Fitz's point earlier, like maybe it's not HIV what's really causing the problem. You know, what maybe is causing this wave of death and destruction in this case, you know, with this kind of what I call a gay men's health crisis, this kind of pre-AIDS wave of death, like could be the result of this, this HepTivax study, but B, this broader program to do who knows what, but, you know, to target populations with this like biological research and testing. And I guess I don't want to go on too long, so I'll just wrap it up and just say there that it is, I think there is a lot of compatibility between these two different theories for sure. I will note, Pierre Duisberg did work with the Special Cancer Virus Program for a little bit in the early 70s. He was doing research into, RSV type diseases and brain tumors or something like that, inducing those. I don't know. But he is part of this kind of like, the science, right? Duisberg himself is like, I think, a member of National Academy of Sciences, which I've heard described as like a Fabian or even Leninist organization or whatever. He is part of the establishment. So I think, I think he may be highlighting a lot of things going on that are fraudulent in the science, but I think there is a lot more to the story. And it, regardless, I think this program deserves attention and we should be asking questions about biodefense.
All right. So now we've got here the basics of these two kind of theories down. One, I guess you could call the Duisberg hypothesis, the idea that HIV is not the cause of AIDS, that it's not necessarily a viral cause at all, but a lifestyle disease or some other combination of factors. And then you've got the other viewpoint that Poolhouse has been talking about, kind of a bioweapon type viewpoint. So with that laid out, I think I'll turn it back to Fitz here with a question, and I'm gonna ask Poolhouse this too, but if AIDS is not caused by HIV, in your view, what is it caused by?
I don't think it's caused by one thing. So I think, for example, like early cases, I'm blank. So like there was Kaposi's sarcoma, and there's another disease, and I'm blanking on the name, but it's basically a disease that you can induce very easily, for example, in mice, by giving them like anabolic steroids and then feeding them a low protein diet at the same time. I'll look it up afterward if people are interested. But so I think that a lot of the original stuff that was being called AIDS, I think part of it was somewhat Duisbergian, in the sense that you had a population group. You had, and actually, let me just back up and say that I think that a lot of what caused AIDS in the United States was that you had a lifestyle emerge, like the fast track gay lifestyle in these urban centers, that was a way of living that really no one had ever lived this way before. Like, no one had ever had that many partners and abused all this huge variety of drugs to that kind of an extent. So I think some of the deaths that we call AIDS were people that were just, I mean, they're doing heroin, coke, steroids, antibiotics. I mean, they would fill rooms with poppers, right? Or like soak rags in them and like inhale it. I mean, it was they were partying so hard. And a lot of that was because homosexuality was not accepted at that time. It was still very taboo. And so you had these groups that were sort of cut off from like normal dating and sort of like romantic standards. I think some of the deaths are because of that. Like Kaposi's sarcoma is definitely a function of just nitrite abuse. Like if you just do enough poppers your entire life, I mean, it's a carcinogen. The FDA regulates it incredibly closely because we know it causes cancer. It's why it's not allowed to be sold for human use. I think that Carrie Mullis, I mean, he died in 2018, but there's an excellent fireside chat. And I think this coincides a little bit with, I don't agree with a lot of the stuff that the Strecker guy says, and a lot of his things I think didn't turn out to be true. But I think one thing he said that is true, and that aligns a lot with Mullis's thesis on like if AIDS is something, what is it? It's basically the immune system being overwhelmed by a incredibly abnormal prevalence, basically, of many different retroviruses in the same body. Like if you think about it, we're host to all of these different viruses, but we may not really supposed to have so many in us at once, right? And so if you take a community of people like the urban gay community of that time, they're passing these things around to each other at so much of a greater rate amongst each other that I think Mullis's thesis is that's basically what AIDS in its purest sense is the immune system getting overwhelmed by that. And that's why he has a very technical description of it, but that's why the retroviral drugs work but can't cure it, is that they stop the action of the retroviruses, but they don't address basically the sort of deeper issue. That's why there's no cure, but if you take these drugs that inhibit them, you know, you can kind of live forever sort of on borrowed time. So I would say Thomas Kuhn made this point, but I think what we call AIDS is a combination of like poverty and shit in Africa, basically in different kinds of immune dysregulation caused by the emergence of kind of like a basically different lifestyle patterns in the, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
I have a quick follow-up question, then we'll go to Pool House. But so people who are HIV positive today, there's still, you know, still a lot of them are gay men. But I think I just wanted to clarify for the listeners, I know what your answer is, but like, HIV is still a sexually transmitted retrovirus. It just doesn't cause AIDS, but you can still get it. It's still you can still get HIV from sex, right?
Yes. And if you have, and the more you have sex with people who are also very promiscuous, the more likely you are to get it, basically.
Right.
Okay, and I have another follow-up here, just because this is something that I've heard about too with regard to AIDS, is what is your perspective on the role of AZT?
That's a really good question. I think I see it as very analogous to the COVID vaccine. If you think about, like in my mind, when I was growing up, when I thought about someone with AIDS, the image in my mind is very similar to, for example, like a cancer patient, right? I mean, my uncle died of cancer, for example. I remember seeing what chemotherapy did to him. He was coughing and he lost all of his hair and he was weak. And I mean, he looked horrible. And, you know, AZT is just chemotherapy. And I think Duesberg's essay on how they got that through the FDA is well worth reading, because it is it's like the most fraudulent clinical trial you can ever imagine. But essentially what they did was they would take people who would test positive for this, what I would argue is basically a mostly harmless passenger virus that may in some cases be representative of another type of a health problem, but for most people is completely benign if you just have HIV. And then they would give you, they'd say, look, take chemotherapy drugs for the rest of your life. Now, what does that do? Like, it kills you, right? I mean, even cancer treatments, I think we can all agree, like, the cancer industry itself is incredibly shady. But as shady as it is, at least they're not saying, take this forever, right? Like, you take it for a certain amount of time. Ideally, it kills, you know, supposedly it kills the cancer cells or whatever, and then you can kind of return to normal life. That's not what they were telling these patients. They were saying, you have to take this forever until you die. They were even, you know, Fauci was giving it to infants. And like, what do you think happened? Like, they got sick. Many died. Fortunately, some people realized that, like, you know, this is making me really ill. They stopped taking it. And a good number of those people lived their entire lives in, you know, perfect health.
Right. And yeah, just for anyone who isn't aware, AZT was one of the first, if not the first drugs that was marketed as a treatment for AIDS, or was it for HIV, or for once you have symptomatic AIDS?
They prescribed it basically if you just had HIV. So the idea was, I mean, they pushed it similar to the way retroviral drugs are pushed now, where it's like, if you're HIV positive, you need to take this immediately.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And yeah, it was before it was used for AIDS or HIV, it was developed as a chemotherapy drug, as you mentioned.
Yes.
And yeah, it causes many of the side effects that chemotherapy drugs do, including death. So Pool House, then, kind of just wanted to get your take on here, as far as, in your perspective, is HIV the cause of AIDS, as in, like, they were actually putting HIV in the vaccines, or like, and then as a kind of follow-up to that question, is HIV transmissible, if the cause is from these vaccine studies, once someone got vaccinated, could they actually then transmit it sexually after that point? Mm-hmm, so two kind of questions there for you.
Yes, I want to call out remdesivir though also, because I think AZT is also very similar to that. There's a lot of overlap with COVID, I said it, and HIV, I guess, but also the cancer industrial kind of complex. There's a lot of overlap between AIDS science, AIDS health, and cancer health, and research. It's very interwoven, I guess. In terms of, I guess, yeah, what causes it, I think that HIVQ is a little bit wrong, sort of. I don't think we need to ask, like, that. It's not really to me about, like, does HIV cause AIDS or not. It's like, what is causing these outcomes in the first place? And I think, I guess, to me, where I guess where I do differ from Fitness Feelings is just it reads to me like an attack. When you, like, look at the waves of death, it does kind of feel to me it hits different. I don't know. It doesn't feel to me as maybe spontaneous, and maybe I'm over dramatizing it. I don't know. I do know that, like, things like in Africa, for example, a lot of the outbreaks in Africa coincide with the kind of locations of these, like, the World Health Organization, like, polio vaccine trials kind of that were going on in the 70s as well. So I don't know. It's possible that it's, you know, it's kind of just maybe more of an organic kind of, or an outcome based off behavior, which I do think the behaviors, I'm not going to let the behavior off the hook either, because I think the answer could be a combination of things, like, right? It could be that these drug use and this kind of, like, kind of hedonistic life actually did something to their immune systems that made them more susceptible. The outcome wasn't maybe even expected, you know, whatever happened, whatever was in these kind of vaccines, which, you know, I don't know if it could be transmitted. It's hard for me to say, because I think so much of what we do know has been misrepresented. But I do feel like there is something that definitely happened that was kind of, like, delivered through this program, delivered through this biological program. And I did want to actually just, I guess what I would say about where I think HIV like it comes from and whether it can be transmitted or not, I think it's summed up maybe a little bit in this quote. It's really short, I promise. It's from Dr. Donald MacArthur, who was a U.S. Army scientist. He was testifying for an appropriations committee during this kind of biological warfare kind of ramp up in 1969. And I also want to note actually that in all of the defense, like kind of authorization bills, like all the appropriations they do every year for defense spending, there's always all of this stuff in there that's like for this biological program. So like extending the ability to like test on human beings, to change the legal regime and how public health can be implemented, because all of public health does have this kind of like DOD kind of defense department underpinning to it, truly at the end of the day. And I really do think the public health is kind of a storefront, and the vaccines and the pharma, all of it is kind of a storefront for this this deeper program inside of the deep state or inside of defense. Dr. MacArthur said within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism, which could differ in certain important aspects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. So he's talking about like things that can kill your immune system. And I think that's important for COVID. We see a lot of outcomes that, you know, render people's immune systems, you know, not working, right? Like with the vaccines, we see that obviously, you know, HIV, that AIDS, that is the idea, right? It's some kind of scenario that's causing people's immune systems to be destroyed. And I think the fact that there was so much research into this and directives from the World Health Organization to scientists to go look into this kind of stuff and plans and intentions kind of buried in all this kind of paperwork, to me, it's not something to ignore, I guess. I think it could be the culprit for a lot of these health outcomes.
Okay, interesting. So then, Poolhouse, I'm going to give you another question here. So I know you've been, to some extent, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you've taken a critical stance towards Duisberg, and or a skeptical stance, let's say, towards the Duisberg hypothesis in the past. What do you view as like the key weakness of that? What do you think that the hypothesis fails to explain about the events that occurred with regards to AIDS?
Okay, sure. I think my read on Duisberg has changed maybe slightly or a little bit. I think I'm a little more charitable now. Here's what I think. Peter Duisberg is a deep state scientist, I guess, himself. He's a Berkeley scientist. He was part of these like government-funded programs. The one thing that always bothered me, I guess, it wasn't even about his argument, honestly. I read his work. I don't really have as many problems as I recall. I didn't know all this stuff then, I guess. But it wasn't so much what he said. It was just that his name was always the one that came up. Anytime you ask anybody about, like, you know, alternative theories of AIDS, it rubbed me the wrong way, I guess, that he is just so domineering in the field. And people don't know maybe a Leon Horowitz or, you know, Dr. Strecker. Definitely, I don't co-sign everything Dr. Strecker had said, but it kind of relegated to kind of this like a small place in history. It feels like it felt counter narrative to me, right? It felt like to me that he was some kind of maybe op, or that his version was being amplified in a way. And he did pay a dear price, I will say. He paid a lot in his career for what he did and what he had written about HIV, because he challenged the establishment very much so there. But I don't know, it's something made me think maybe he's being elevated somehow, kind of like, you know, just disinformation, right? Or maybe just to confuse muddle the waters, what have you. Part of me does wonder though, if maybe, okay, this is a weird theory, but maybe like Peter Duisberg has some knowledge or is aware that maybe he was part of research that did result in these outcomes, that maybe in some way he was complicit, and maybe knows he can't necessarily go and like say all that, right? He'll just end up like, you know, Carrie Mullis or whatever, you know, he'll just end up gone. But he instead maybe took a different tack, which was to kind of undermine virology at large. Like his work really does bring a lot of questions. Why aren't they, especially in the AIDS area, but why don't they use Koch's postulate? I think for COVID or coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2 or whatever as well. I don't think they've done any of the kind of rigor that you would normally expect for validation of that virus. And so something to me makes me think that he was maybe playing some kind of like game. He worked with Francis or with Robert Gallo. He works with Montagnier. All these like people are very insular in this field. And I don't know. There's something about what happened there that kind of makes me think he was trying to shine a light on the fraud of what the science really is all about.
Fair point. So Fitness Feelings, I'll toss it back to you there and just give you a chance if you have any thoughts on the bioweapon hypothesis or like if you view as like a weakness or just that something that hypothesis doesn't adequately explain. And then I have some more questions for both of you. But
sure. Well, so I guess I'll start with what I agree with. And so what I agree with, first of all, is that absolutely, I mean, the deep state and the sort of biomedical whatever thing, I mean, that is, they are in lockstep, not to borrow that stupid Rockefeller term. And not only are they, I mean, you can look at, for example, the Wellcome Trust and all of these kind of Anglo-American biotech mafias that were kind of behind a lot of the stuff that went on with HIV/AIDS were the same people that were pushing the imperial model and all the COVID crap, Fauci. I mean, it's the same little group, right? So I'm in complete agreement with Poolhouse on that point. And I also am in agreement that I would be more surprised if they weren't trying to develop bioweapons and testing them on people. I mean, I am 100% sure they are doing that to some extent. The exact specifics of how that's done or whatever is just simply something I haven't looked into. But I have no doubt that happened then. I'm sure it's still happening. They're really into that. So I co-sign all of that 100%. I think the point that I disagree with is a kind of a more fundamental biological point. And that is, and it really has to do to some extent, for example, with this idea, for example, of cancer virology. In my opinion, viruses cannot really cause cancer in the way that we imagine. And that's actually a lot of what Duisberg's work showed. So for example, there's only one time ever that Rhucous sarcoma virus, that a virus was shown to be able to directly cause cancer in these chickens. And Duisberg was the one who he made his name basically explaining and sort of proving how that happened. But as a part of that process, what he realized was that that was a sort of fluke, that they had taken the virus in this state, basically, this sort of aberrant state that would have been weeded out as a part of the retrovirus's natural sort of movement through populations, because viruses do not really have an incentive to kill their hosts. And further, that cancer, you know, cancer is really a disease of like oxidative metabolism, right? Everyone has cancer. Everyone has cancer in their body all the time. But in a healthy organism, you can deal with it. It's when the metabolism and the immune system become compromised, right? The energetic structure of the organism becomes compromised, that cancer then becomes an issue. So I'm not saying that I know for sure that, you know, they can't give somebody a virus that causes cancer. Maybe they can. But I think the reason why there's so much cancer now is because, I mean, I agree with Poolhouse in that a lot of it, I think, is because of vaccines, right? Messing with people's sort of immune system, and also because of the incredibly estrogenic and sort of toxic environment and the downstream effects of that. But I think it's good, in my opinion, if there were bioweapons research into these sort of cancer viruses and so forth, like if you look at the Gallo's like leukemia virus, it's really clear if you look at his research, I mean, maybe there's some deeper research that we're not aware of, but on the surface, that's just fraud, right? Like that leukemia virus doesn't cause leukemia in anyone. Like it's overwhelmingly clear that you're no more likely to get leukemia with that virus than you are not. And he created a fake correlation by renaming the leukemia if you had that virus to make it seem like it was 100% correlated, right? But it's just literally like a fiction based on naming. And so I would be careful, I guess. I guess I'm just not sure how I feel about like that specific portion of it, but no argument that the cancer research stuff, that all went on, and I'm sure that they attempted to figure out, can we give people cancer with viruses? I mean, I don't have any doubt that that question was raised and investigated. I'm just not sure that it could have succeeded just due to kind of like inherent biological constraints.
I just wanted to mention as an addendum there that like there's this, I'm sure you guys have seen this, but there's this huge push now for like everything is caused by viruses. Like I saw an article like, is Alzheimer's a virus? Is, you know, like they're just like coming. And I think the reason for that is pretty obvious because there's a monetary, you know, if everything's caused by viruses and you can make a vaccine for everything, then you make a lot of money, you know?
And virology is for whatever reason, I mean, it's important to note that like when people discovered bacteria, right, this was like, it blew people's minds. It's like, holy, there's these, we can actually explain these conditions from this tiny little organism. And they thought even at that time that bacteria could explain cancer, right? They thought that like, okay, bacteria can explain everything. When they realized that wasn't true, later, when they discovered viruses, it was like, oh, okay, this is the piece that we've been missing. It's actually viruses that, you know, they cause everything else. But the reality is just that's not really how human biology works. And I think that one of the things a lot of this stuff does is it's meant to make you really afraid of viruses and think that virology is this important thing that we need to be worried about and focused on and worry about other companies developing viruses. In my opinion, viruses are just not that important. I do think there's a biological war sort of being waged, but I think it's in kind of a different way. Although I don't rule out the possibility that there is some like virological technology that is so advanced, perhaps, that it's just simply beyond our ability to understand how it works. And in that case, I mean, there's really not much what we can do.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, another thing about viruses causing cancer that you hear a lot about, and of course is a big pharmaceutical market, is the HPV stuff.
Yeah, and it's completely fake. I mean, it's completely fake. Yeah.
What do you have any more thoughts on that? I don't know too much about it.
I mean, HPV does not cause cancer, right? I mean, it's one of those things where it's back to the latency thing, right? Where it's like, HPV is a disease that it causes acute symptoms, right? In basically strikes young women, okay? And it also infects men, right? Cervical cancer is something that affects almost exclusively women that are, you know, senior citizens, right? So again, the argument here is that the HPV virus somehow gets into you. It's back to the AIDS model, right? And then 50 years later, it causes cancer through some completely unexplained mechanism. Like, it doesn't make any sense. That's not how viruses work. Like, they're very simple, unadaptive, you know, almost like the wind or something, like just sort of forces of nature.
Can I respond quickly? Because I do want to say, I generally, actually, honestly, still kind of agree. The cancer piece of it's interesting because the special virus cancer program, they were going into that, right? They're looking into the cancer stuff ostensibly, but they do have this whole archive in their published reports. It's like this, they're candidate viruses. They're not looking just at cancer-causing viruses at the end of the day. That's like the program name, but they're looking at Zika. They're looking at a lot of different things. I do agree. I think virologists are liars, first of all. I think they're all liars and they're like warlocks, essentially. But like effectively, I think where the threat of viruses to me is real is not so much like through the spread in populations. It's through targeted induction. It's like putting it in a vaccine, giving it to somebody directly. I do think that it's probably not good to have. I don't think we're supposed to have animal viruses injected in it. I don't think we're supposed to have anything injected through our beautiful skin that is there to protect us. But, you know, like putting other viruses from other animals is not a great idea, in my opinion. And I think there is, you know, evidence that those would have harmful outcomes. Maybe aren't going to spread across the country and maybe not going to cause like the pan the pandemics that, you know, they use to kind of drum up fear. But I do think their research does suggest they're looking for ways to kill people through like these, through these viruses, you know. So I do agree. And I will say, though, I don't know this very well, but my understanding is in some of the tests that they do today still for like cancer, one of those tests is for a viral component. I don't know that much about it, so I shouldn't even raise it. So there is, to me, again, there is just something, maybe what is cancer? You know, there is a specific definition of cancer cells, but does everyone, you know, how is that even diagnosed? I don't know that much about it. We know so much about public health and all of these kinds of fields of science is about misrepresenting like kind of what's going on, you know? So at the end of the day, I think that's the fundamental thing, is that kind of disconnect between kind of what we're told and what's really happening, you know?
Can I ask a bioweapon follow-up? And this isn't like a critique. It's just something I've heard people say. Like, there was that big wave of people on Twitter recently who were like, oh, so the idea of the vaccines was you're going to get a vaccine and then years and years and years and years later, like something bad is going to happen to you and you're going to die. And they were sort of using like what Fitch just said about HPV, but they were sort of using that to like discredit vaccine conspiracy theories, because they were like, why wouldn't this like weapon like work better? Like, you know what I mean? Like, how come so many people got it and there wasn't just this, you know, like, you just didn't die immediately. And I'm curious what you think about that, Poolhouse and Fitz. I'm sure you guys have like very smart responses, but that's something that I've seen lately on Twitter a lot of.
I mean, that assumes, I guess, I guess that would assume that there was like a plan to kill every person who took a vaccine. I guess I don't know the objectives for sure, but with the COVID-19 vaccines, I think one piece is like a placebo effect. We don't know how many people got like a real shot per se. The entire program through Warp Speed is like, it's unreal. If you really start to understand what they did, it's theater. It's theater. The trials, the way that things were produced, it was all, it's very hard to describe it and explain quickly, but it's a theater. It's an operation. It's a psyop. So there's a psyop happening.
I don't know if you guys
remember,
just to add to your theater point, that like when they initially rolled out the mRNA vaccines, they kept talking about how you needed these like special deep freezers to in order to keep them activated or whatever, and you could only have them out of the freezer for like 10 minutes or something. I forget, you know, whatever shit it was. And then now you don't hear anything about that, you know.
Exactly
bullshit.
yeah I mean, I want to say briefly, I want to say I think that Poolhouse is right about the vaccine thing. So I just don't want to make, I want to make it very clear that I am 100% in agreement, actually, that vaccine, you know, they injecting people with stuff that a vaccine is, it's a virus, but it's a virus that's basically meant to like it's a viral concoction, virus-based concoction that's meant to reprogram your immune system. That I think could absolutely and does cause not only cancer, but a huge variety of other type of health effects that are not totally understood, but that there is significant evidence for. And to address your question about, okay, well, wouldn't this work better? Yeah, I mean, obviously, we don't, to the point Poolhouse already made, we don't know how many were real, and there's all kinds of, we could get in, there's very complex features of that argument about the intensity of the vaccines based on the length of the tail that protected the NRA and the different batches and so forth that we could get into. But briefly, yeah, why would they want to kill everyone at once? That would sort of collapse society, one. But then two, the difference in any kind of scientific question is not, like, I'm not saying that it's impossible that some virus or some other thing could cause a disease 50 years later. I'm saying there's no evidence for that in, for example, the case of HPV. Like, there is no proposed mechanism. There is no study. There is nothing that shows that is the case. On the vaccine question, I think there is evidence, right? Precisely for the reason that it is reprogramming the immune response of the organism, right? In a way that is not fully understood. And we don't, you know, it would not shock me if that caused, you know, a whole variety of conditions right down the road, specifically because most modern disease is basically some kind of miscalibrated immune response where the body ends up attacking itself. And so yeah, I don't think that's a very, I think for those people, I don't think that's a very strong point.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess like another response is, it's like if the goal is to, who knows what the goal was? I think that's smart to say too.
Yeah. Well, people also end up clients, right? Yeah. You end up a client of the farm, the Rockefeller Medicine industrialized model, regardless. So maybe it wasn't ever, you know, exactly. We don't know the point. Maybe that was part of the point. You know, this is kind of getting to what like Judy Mikovits says is like the plague of corruption, which is, you know, like all these things are being caused essentially by vaccines. And a lot of the science is just kind of reverse engineering ways to explain anything but that, that it's not what the, it's not what the medicine we're giving you isn't what's making you sick. It's every single thing else. And I think you see that theme with every one of these kind of pandemics or epidemics.
And I think we all, I think it's safe to say, would agree that like depopulation is broadly a goal of the powers that be. But as Fitz alluded to, they can't just like kill everyone immediately, because then society would collapse, the banking system would collapse, and that's what their goal is, to keep that running. But you can also achieve depopulation not just through killing people, but also just kind of maybe disincentivizing them to reproduce if they just kind of have some weird chronic disease or they have low energy or whatever, or by sterilizing them effectively, which you also hear about as a side effect of the vaccines.
Yeah, or by saying having sex will kill you.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. There you go. Mm-hmm. I think this is sort of a, I don't know, this is, anyways, I'll just ask the question. Because I was thinking about this when you were talking about Koch's postulates, which again are kind of this standard for determining if a pathogen causes a disease. And it's like, what it's like, the all cases of the disease must have the pathogen present, and all the pathogen in every case must cause the disease. And then there's one more, right? Or
there's three. Yeah. You have to basically, the third one is you have to be able to basically give the pathogen to a healthy organism and reproduce the disease.
Okay. Yeah. What is your take on, like, to me, it seems like that if you accept that those postulates are needed in order to prove that a pathogen causes a disease, doesn't that basically undermine virology, like, as a whole, sort of?
What do you mean by that?
Well, like, you know, for example, they were saying, like, you could have asymptomatic COVID, right? And so I think that's just one example, but I feel like there's many cases where, three out of four members of a family have come down with a flu, and one person randomly doesn't get sick. I mean, it's presumably not because that person hasn't been exposed to the virus causing a disease, right? Like, there must be some other factor that determines whether or not the exposed person contracts the disease.
Yeah. So, like, in terms of Koch's postulates, the idea is not that, like, if I inject you with some pathogen, that it has to reproduce the same symptoms 100% of the time, right? Okay. But basically, it does work in the sense that we can take malaria or something, for example. If I inject 1,000 people with malaria, the vast majority of them are going to get malaria unless we can test them and see that they have some kind of immunity to it, right? Obviously, there are, you know, things about the metabolism and the immune system and so forth that, like, yeah, some people can just fight it off or whatever. They don't experience the sort of symptoms. But broadly speaking, you can reproduce it. It's the same with almost every disease that we vaccinate for, or like we legitimately vaccinate for, I'll say. I don't want to say that either. But where we can at least, there's like some kind of vague argument that the vaccination is preventing the disease. Like, let's say with smallpox or something. That, you know, if you just inject a random person like full blast of that, you know, there's a pretty good chance that they're going to get sick. And if we do it to 10,000 people, you know, the majority are going to have, you know, they're going to get the disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. So yeah, I don't really have too many more questions, but I don't know if either or both of you have any just closing thoughts or anything that you wanted to touch on that you haven't gotten to yet.
Yeah, I guess I would just say, yeah, this idea again of just what you're even just talking about here with Koch's postulates, it's there's a lot of scientific fraud, I guess, for lack of a better term. I think people would be surprised to know that HIV didn't meet those terms, right? I think people would be surprised. Go read the official way that HIV is co-discovered by Dr. Gallo and Dr. Montagnier on separate sides of the Atlantic, but they get exactly the same specimen. It's bizarre. It's complete fraudulence. Dr. Gallo actually gets censured, basically scientifically censured at one point for stealing the research. He stole it. It's fraudulent. I was reading this report. It's very interesting that apparently in the early 90s, before the official history of all this was being kind of put together for Science Magazine, or maybe it was Nature Magazine, they met with Jonas Salk, and they had these sessions with Jonas Salk to kind of coordinate messaging, sort of. And it was just so surprising to me. It's like, why does Jonas Salk need to be there? Well, he's the founder of the polio vaccine, inventor of the polio vaccine. And to me, the interconnections between all of these actors, you see, I mentioned Dr. Hilleman before from Merck, he turns up in all these different places. Key actors and key institutions turn up time and time again, whether it's HIV or whether it's COVID-19, literally so many of the same people. And I think it might be it's a tough pill to swallow, I guess what I'm saying, there's deep state forces trying to poison you and your family. There are. You should be prepared for those. I kind of just look into that maybe. But at the end of the day, I do think that it is it's not inconceivable, and it's plausible. It's provable that there is some kind of scientific conspiracy with this kind of consortium of actors between the state, the private, the private sector, and NGOs, of course.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, Fitz, any closing thoughts here? Or,
I mean, I think for me, the main thing I would suggest to people in conclusion, first of all, with regards to the whole HIV, AIDS, whatever thing, I mean, it's really something where it's worth, I think, for anyone who is listening to this and maybe thinks that one or both of us are crazy for suggesting that the Gallo, Fauci, whatever narrative is not, it's basically not true in to some or all in some or all of its parts, is to go and actually go back, and it's very informative to look at the quote scientific debate that was had about this, because it is incredibly ridiculous and one-sided. When you read the Gallo rebuttals to the dissent or whatever, it's something that no one could possibly take seriously. It's utterly preposterous. And so, the fact that that's the narrative that has remained so sacrosanct, right? So unimpeachable. I mean, that is in and of itself not only not really scientific, right? In the sense that science is supposed to be a sort of objective, unemotional search for fact, however uncomfortable that is. But I think it to Poolhouse's point, it underscores just how manipulated this whole system really is, right? That it is, it's not the legitimate, it's not what it purports to be. And because it's something, our health is something that affects all of us very deeply and personally, not only in terms of our physical experience, but our sense of ourselves as a person and our psychology and so forth. It's worth educating yourself on, because, these are still the people that are running things. And it's very unlikely that they've had, just a huge change of heart and all of a sudden they're looking, they're looking out for us, and all the malfeasance and corruption and, possibly even outright biological attacks on the population has stopped. And so I just think it's a good thing to be aware of.
These are the people they say have a consensus. Just put it that way. These are the people they say have a consensus, and you shouldn't challenge ever under any circumstance.
I also think as someone who was like really skeptical going into this, it's like if you really just start reading a little bit, a lot, you'll see that what they're saying is true. Especially do some deep dives on HIV tests and how like bad and weird and like they are. They don't even really test for HIV. So I think it's worth it. I think it's worth some Googling. There's a lot of there's a lot of stuff you find out that you're like, oh, this was actually only like one Google away that HIV tests are basically fake, you know? So,
Dune, I heard from an activist eyewitness. He said that the U equal U, this kind of like undetectable equals untransmissible, this whole PrEP kind of campaign. He said that the level that they use for that now is what was considered full blown AIDS in like 1987. It's like, it's a pretty big jump. It's like all of it's so, it's all bogus. You're totally right.
Changing what undetectable means. I did laugh. I almost laughed out loud when Fitz said the thing about how bad a virus would be if you have to have anal sex 1,000 times to transmit it. It's like this virus was just waiting for gay guys. It was like all of human history.
Oh my gosh, what viruses will the bunty unleash when they finally drill that hole?
Oh, yeah, there's a great Carrie Mullis interview that I think you can still find on YouTube where he talks about like the testing issue and how it's all fake. He's the inventor of the PCR test, and also just all about how Fauci was a fraud and how there's no evidence. There was never not a single paper published that claim to explain the mechanism by which HIV causes AIDS.
Yeah, it's with Gary Null. Is the interviewer.
I also just want to make the point, I guess, at the very end that, like, looking into this stuff, none of that means that you shouldn't feel like bad for people who died of AIDS. Like, even if it was a lifestyle condition, like we feel sad about stuff that people theoretically could be called lifestyle conditions all the time, diabetes, things like that, you know? So
none of this
means that like you don't have, like, none of this is implying that like there's no empathy anywhere. There's nothing sad about this. It just seems like the mainstream narrative is not true.
And if there's, I would like to make a jump off that just for a second and say, you know, particularly the kind of conspiracy leftists, They I remember some of them got so angry at me for bringing some of this stuff. They act like you're, you know, Hitler or something for, you know, basically making what's whether it's right or wrong, it's just a purely kind of empirical point. But Hugh, to the point that you raised, I think a lot of the people that died, I mean, they were somewhat, many of them were just literally given like poisonous drugs that killed them when they were completely healthy. But many others, you know, they died because they were misled. Right, like if they had been told, if all of the facts had been made available to them, they might very well have made different choices, and they would have survived. Right, there's actually nothing kind about perpetrating this idea that the virus and so forth, and just kind of going along with, you know, Dr. Fauci's ride or whatever. Like there's nothing actually good about that. You know, it would have been much kinder to tell people the truth and then let them make their own choices.
I'll add also in the 80s there were plenty of AIDS deniers or dissidents, as they were called, AIDS dissidents, and it was people, Duisburgians, people saying things I'm saying, a wider spectrum, people were asking for answers. All that gets kind of swept away, we get ACT UP and they're kind of pro-pharma agitation or whatever, but this was not something that was like, it wasn't, you know, in the mainstream, but it was something that was being discussed, and there were conferences and publications and groups that met of all stripes.
Yeah, and I think that there were a lot of, just again, to go to the point, like none of this is saying, like, there were tons of gay men who were suspicious of the mainstream narrative on AIDS too. It was just, like you said, ACT UP came in and kind of that was it, you know, that became the, and by the way, I think it is worth pointing out, what was the guy's name, the founder of ACT UP? Was that Larry Kramer?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was.
Well, he died like last year at 84. So I think it's worth mentioning that he had HIV since the 80s, and he lived a pretty standard lifespan, above the US average.
Magic Johnson.
Yeah, Magic Johnson, another one. It's like there's a lot of people who are fine.
And it wasn't new drugs, by the way. It wasn't new drugs that they started giving to these patients. It was it was like a cocktail of existing drugs, just like maybe like an ivermectin, Corsetin, whatever, like kind of combination. It was exactly the kind of same concept that we have with like kind of the alternative treatments or suppressed treatments for COVID. They did the exact same thing, kind of essentially there. I just think it's really worth noting that they withheld things. I think they suppressed science, let a lot of people kind of die and gave them poison like they did in COVID-19. And the reason it's important, even though it's dark, is because you need to be prepared and vigilant when they kind of offer similar suggestions to you kind of in the future, you know?
Yeah, I think actually the Dallas Buyers Club movie with Matthew McConaughey does a pretty good job of like highlighting the just kind of desperate search for effective alternative treatments.
Interesting.
Yeah, my theory on Magic Johnson is he doesn't have HIV at all. It was just a psyop to get the black community. Because we're supposed to believe that he got HIV from having normal heterosexual sex. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
Well, there's so supposedly other cases of that too. Like, Eazy-E died of AIDS, supposedly.
Okay, Eazy-E was having anal sex with Jerry, what's his name, from the record company. Yeah, no, that's serious. He's a rapper. That doesn't apply.
He did.
Then Magic Johnson happened. It convinced a lot of people, like, this is your problem too. Look, this like normal, like straight guy can get HIV. Just like, that's why I'm just suspicious of the whole narrative.
That's a whole other thing. But the whole way they rolled out the propaganda really does remind me of COVID. And they overblew it with the straight population. They kind of made it seem much more, dramatic than it was.
Yeah. And yeah. Poolhouse, you mentioned earlier about how like it's scary to realize that like there's a group of elites that want to kill us or whatever.
Yeah.
I want to do a series on the pod inspired by your PowerPoint that you plan to share with your family called "They're Trying to Kill Us," because I think it is an apropos summation of the situation. And yeah, I actually had an idea to do a one on like water fluoridation and polyunsaturated fats, and kind of combine those two as like an assault on like the thyroid and metabolism. So that one might be a good one to have fitness feelings back for. So
I approve. I like it. It's very dramatic. It reminds me of this like CBS News used to do Fleecing of America. They did the segment that was all about like the ways that you're getting like cheated by the government, but They're Trying to Kill Us like takes it to the next level. I love that.
They're Trying to Kill Us. All right. So thank you, gentlemen, both for joining us. I think it was an illuminating discussion here. Q, did you have any more thoughts or questions?
No, I was just laughing because I was scrolling through the Bronze Age Shardy lawsuit, and it actually has the tweet that she got fired for, which was looking fear in the eyes today as I'm using the ADA gender-neutral restroom in the office, and a retarded tranny in a wheelchair knocks on the door. So that's actually like literally quoted in the lawsuit, and I just think it's
great
funny.
Post, yeah.
I just think it's so funny that this is like this is how it's going down. But whatever. Happy for her. Hope she gets a lot of money.
Amen.
That's it. We could close on Bronze
tweet. All right. Well, thanks, guys, and I think people will be interested in this episode. So,
thanks for having me. That was really fun.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Take it easy.